The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Another day in Denver here in the studios of KUVO Public Radio. We look into the joys of innovation and creativity in the new economy, all the pitfalls and seduction of 21st century innovation hype, we'll take a look at that, and the challenge of getting your little personal information raft out of the rapids, folks, making the channels of media in our lives settle down so we can choose what we want to get done. Also, try getting anything creative done without a sewing machine if you work with fabric. We pay homage to the sewing machine with a Hollywood costume designer. But we begin with the decision this week. President Obama announced a ban on solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons. Yesterday, the Supreme Court made retroactive a 2012 ruling which says juvenile offenders cannot be given life without parole sentences, meaning that the 2,000 juveniles nationwide who are currently serving unconstitutional sentences, life without parole, but convicted before 2012, and many of them now adults, might have their sentences reviewed and overturned. People like Eric Jensen, who was 17 years old back in 1998 when he was sentenced to life without parole for a murder he witnessed and did not commit. He turned to his father and mother as he was led from the courtroom with no understanding of what life without parole even meant. Today, he has more of an idea, having spent nearly half of his life behind bars here in the state of Colorado. Kurt Jensen is Eric's father and is founder of the Colorado Pendulum Foundation, which he and his wife founded back in 2001 to help educate the public about the issues of children in adult prisons serving life without parole. Kurt Jensen is here in the studio. Mr. Jensen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What did the Supreme Court say to you and your family yesterday?
Finally, they said to Colorado, I guess, and just a very few other states, that life without parole given to juveniles is no longer a sentence that should be used, and that we, Colorado, should now change our law 3 years after they made their original ruling.
And what were the circumstances of your son's incarceration?
He was with his friend, Nate, who at that time killed his mother. Eric was in the other room, came in just as it was being accomplished. And Eric was convicted of being a complicitor, which is a very complicated thing to analyze, as an adult, even though he was an adult. He was tried and convicted as an adult.
And because of the Colorado felony murder linkage law, if a murderer is convicted in the act of committing a felony and complicitor is a felony, then you're punished the same way as if you were a murderer, right?
Yes.
And how did you feel when the sentence was passed?
We were absolutely shocked. I mean, we didn't believe that the jury would say that. We thought they were offered several other alternatives, and they said, no, it's complicitor and murder. And the judge wasn't even ready to pronounce a sentence. At that time, and still this is true, for juveniles in Colorado, there's only one sentence. That's the only place in the whole criminal statutes of Colorado for juveniles. And that one sentence is life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Did you feel as though some emotional reaction was being played out? This poor woman, boy, we're going to really show you kind of feeling, and then that ended up putting...
The entire sheriff's office sat in the courtroom, and one of the sheriff's daughter was on the jury, one of his deputies' wife was on the jury, and a former police chief was on the jury. It was a trial that was held at the very same time that Columbine was a big national event. Our address was Littleton, Colorado, and our son's name was Eric, which was one of the perpetrators in Columbine. So it was very high profile.
And at that point, you know, life without parole for Eric Jensen, your son, and you have no options.
None.
At that point.
None. Once you realize what the justice system can do when it is determined to do something, and that what you can't do and what won't be done for you, it's very a very helpless feeling. Most people just give up. We didn't. We said, no, we're going to try to get these laws changed for everybody.
What does the Colorado Pendulum Foundation do to that end?
The Pendulum Foundation was founded originally and still is in order to change the juvenile justice laws so that we get back to having juvenile justice instead of juveniles tried as adults. Not just tried as adults, but sentenced as adults and sentenced to adult prisons. Once you're sentenced in Colorado as an adult, no matter what your age, you're sent to adult prisons. You're not sent to the juvenile justice system. We have one. We, in fact, Colorado was one of the very first states that had a juvenile justice system. But we have since allowed that to be abandoned for many, many kids that are convicted in Colorado. There's about 400 to 500 juveniles now in Colorado prisons serving sentences that are longer than they were old when they were given that sentence.
The courts suggested that because of the commission of this crime, that Eric, as a 17-year-old, was all grown up. What did you see as he was led out of the courtroom with that sentence of life without parole? Did you see a grown-up? What did you see?
Certainly not. Juveniles, it's been shown in the courts since then, and in fact by the Supreme Court of the United States, that juveniles are not grown up at that point. They may have the right look of being an adult, but they're not an adult in their head. They haven't got the ability to see into the future and to understand the consequences of what's going on around them. And that's why the court has said that these kinds of sentences are not constitutional.
But remembering back to that sentencing moment, did your son have any idea what was going to happen?
He was bewildered. I mean, he turned around and looked at us and said, what happened? What? Because the judge on that moment said, you're hereby sentenced to life in prison without parole. And he had no concept at that point what that really meant, how long that really meant, and what was going to happen to the rest of his life.
What's his experience in prison been like? What has he had to go through? Solitary,
like,
those
yes,
kinds of things?
Like many of the juveniles, and this is one of the great sadnesses of the way we do prisons in the United States, especially when we throw juveniles in there, is that most of the juveniles back in those days, they put them in isolation at some point during their trials or during their prison terms. Generally early on, because they're juveniles and they're acting out and they've been given long, long, long sentences that exceed their age. They go into, at that point, he would spend for 2.5 years in an isolation prison. Yeah. And the only time he could come out was once a week for a shower, once a week to work out in another cell for 30 minutes, and once a week when we came to visit him, he was at all times held in chains on his arms and legs, and never allowed to see another human being.
I mean, did you watch him deteriorate?
It did. He took it a lot better than I would have. I can tell you that if that had happened to me, if they'd have put me in solitary for 2.5 years, I'd probably be crazy by now. He took it a lot better than that, but it happens to you over time that you get paranoid about things that aren't even correct or not necessarily that way. It takes you quite a while after you get out of solitary to get back to understanding that you're back in the, quote, real world, as opposed to just looking and talking to yourself.
What's the earliest that Eric might be released?
His sentence was just declared unconstitutional. Colorado, we're still very, very unhappy about this. 3 years after the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that that sentence was unconstitutional, Colorado has not yet introduced one bill, not a law, nothing, to change the laws in Colorado to go along with that Supreme Court sentence. The legislators and the governor and others have all wanted to be very non-controversial, don't want anything in front of them that might give somebody the feeling that they've done anything controversial, even though all the other states, except for three or four, all the other states in the United States have changed their laws, mostly making them more like 20 years for this kind of a crime instead of life without parole. Colorado doesn't have any law, nor do they have one in front of the legislature now, this meeting today.
So no idea when Eric would get out?
There's no way. And until some court comes back to the state of Colorado, probably a federal court, because our state court here was one of the very few who said that that law was not retroactive when it was, and the Supreme Court just ruled that yesterday that it was retroactive. some court someday is going to have to tell the governor and the legislature, I'm sorry, you have to do something. I think the Supreme Court just did that yesterday.
Well, this could happen fast. If a federal court issues an injunction, he's on the street.
Yes.
What's the first thing you're going to do?
Take him someplace where he can see what modern life is like. They don't see the stars or the moon at this prison and most prisons because there's such bright lights above them watching the yard so that they can't even see outside. They can't, of course, they can't use modern phones or computers or anything else that we think that we take for granted. So he basically needs to get back into understanding what life is like.
Do you think it's possible, in all of your experience here, that a teenager, not your son, but that a teenager could commit a crime that is so heinous it would be eligible, that life without the possibility of parole would be an appropriate sentence? Is a teenager, is a minor capable of something like that under any circumstances?
I think that there are some crimes that we as a society want to make sure before that person comes back into society that that's not something that's going to reoccur. By and large, what the prison system have found out is that juveniles who commit this kind of crime never commit another crime of any kind. Mm. But I do believe that there are some guys that are in there now that have been given life without parole and that committed heinous crimes, and that if I were sitting on a jury panel or if I were a judge or if I were the parole board, I might have very strong feelings that one's not ready yet. But I don't think that it's up to us to decide that at the time that they're 16, 15, 14, to decide that's what they're going to serve, a life without parole because of what they just did. I think what we can say is we're going to put them in there for a long period of time and give them a chance to find out whether or not they've ever will be rehabilitated and actually work on rehabilitation, which our prisons don't do at all. It's not a system that works for juveniles at all. Our juvenile system does try to work for juveniles, but our senior prisons are just too full.
Finally, Kurt Jensen, Supreme Court decision yesterday was something that made you happy. I asked this question at the top of the hour. Where do you go to get your son's childhood back?
He has taken courses in several university courses. He's got a degree from an associate's degree from Indiana University. So he's got to start his life over again from this point forward. He can't go back and become that juvenile that he was when they put him in there. Even though we might like that, that's not the way the world works. So he's got to move on as though he's just another human being on the street today.
So the state can take your son's childhood?
They did.
And there's nothing you can do about that?
No. Again, once you realize how the system works, when they take your child and make your child an adult for sentencing, an adult in court, and they say guilty, that's the end of the line.
Kurt Jensen, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
Gather, gather, gather now, you digital child voices of the 21st century. That's right. Pipe down. Quiet, right? You two over there. Relax. Tune in. Turn off. All together now. Isn't that better? Back to basics. For some, that feels good. For others, there's a feeling of being buried in calm. What am I missing?
Input.
Woo! Broadcast in 5 minutes.
What?
How is that even possible?
Fear in the sky.
Lockdown.
Washington on high alert.
Wall Street today? Forget about it.
It's fumbled. It is picked up.
All of those issues came up in the debate. Here's a taste.
This is NPR.
Do you really feel better? Is all this really necessary? I suppose we're as guilty as anyone here on The Takeaway, delivering information, news, voices, all in quick bursts. Finally this hour, how anxiety can be the mother of invention in the quest to keep the wonder and sheer volume of information and design and innovation and the flow of changing technology from overwhelming us all. First, here's the anxiety.
I have a terrifyingly lengthy catalog of bookmarks filed under Read Later and an ever-growing list of podcasts I should listen to, books I should read. It's like a different flavor of FOMO. It's fear of missing out, but missing out on content and on knowledge.
That's Kelsey Lukowski, a listener to the Note to Self podcast from WNYC Studios, hosted by Manoush Zomorodi. And because this is what Manoush does, she's turning that anxiety into inspiration for a whole new project at Note to Self. Manoush, welcome back.
Great to be here, John.
It's great to talk to you. So what did Kelsey do to inspire you to really think about a whole range of issues here?
Well, Kelsey and so many of our listeners, Note to Self listeners, had questions about focus, this inability to sort of deal with all the information coming at us, whether it's via status updates or old-fashioned newspapers or podcasts or great Netflix shows. There's this desire to consume everything. There is a delightful abundance of information out there. But the problem is our brains simply cannot keep up with the internet.
And this is different than multitasking. This is a new way of focusing or to think about how you focus. Is that right?
Well, what we're doing with InfoMagical, so what we're doing with it is it's a week of experiments sort of designed to help you find focus and what we're calling the magic of clear thinking. But the goal is to make information overload disappear. We're not saying there's anything wrong with information, but what we're saying is you need to decide what you want to get out of it. And so we're asking people to set a goal. So we've identified five goals: more in touch with friends and family, more up to date on the news, more creative, more in tune with yourself, or more knowledgeable about a specific subject. And what we want to try to measure essentially is, you know, when you set an information goal, what sort of effect does that have on your overload? Does it lessen it in some way? Now, over last count, over 6,000 people have signed up. And I was surprised. The majority have chosen that they want their goal to be more in tune with their self.
Who's taking a look at how we can take what we've got right now and make it better as you do these 6,000 experiments or so?
Well, you know, not a lot of people, actually. And so what we hope to do with our data is bring it to the technologists and to the cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists and say, here's what we have seen. How can we apply this? I mean, we don't expect to do this on our own. But what we want to do is say we've taken this group of people, which we hope will grow, and we have discovered that when we do small sort of time-specific challenges, maybe we can make a difference in our lives. You know, John, the average American consumed 12 hours of media per day in 2015. So some of it simultaneously, you know, Twitter and watching TV at the same time. And we spoke to historians who say actually information overload has been dated back to the 13th century. This is not a new problem, but what is new is our inability to sort of make sense of it all. One cognitive psychologist I spoke to said between 40 and 50% of the information we take in does not get synthesized or stored or made meaning of at all. And so why are we wasting our time?
You know, you listen to three or four Gregorian chants all at once, and it's just cacophony. I love that we learned that Intel has an anthropologist who works in-house.
Yes, that's right. We do. Genevieve Bell, she is an amazing person, and she sort of looks at how different cultures cope with different sort of trends. But specifically with technology, she believes we are really at a crossroads, that we are at a point where we've been so in love with it, but now we need to sort of lift our eyes and get on with our lives and decide how do we make our technology more purposeful, not just suck it all in and wallow in it and roll around in it.
How do we as human beings, as families, as communities, as countries, as cultures, how do we start to work through what our relationships are to the technology? I don't think we want to go back to not having them, but working through what the appropriate social, familial, community, cultural, country level norms will be is a work in progress, and we're still in the middle of it.
And this Note to Self project here puts your listeners on a front line of experimentation. This isn't the Luddite exercise. This is a
no.
This is a way of really embracing technology and using the complexity of our own brains to meet realistic goals about how we want to think about ourselves and our families.
That's absolutely right. So on day one, for example, we are calling it single tasking day. It's making it a magical day. And this is, you know, backed by neuroscience. You've probably heard that about decision fatigue or the fact that multitasking is indeed a myth. Actually, what we're doing is task switching. But what we're learning is other things. Like, for example, if you have a crazy hour at work, John, like people are stopping by your desk, you're getting so many emails, you're interrupted constantly. The next hour, you will start interrupting yourself. So we get into these self-perpetuating cycles of interruption or setting expectations for ourselves that we can stay up to date on absolutely everything, when actually we are learning that physically that is simply not possible.
Well, I, with a daily radio show, Manoush, I'm kind of the chimp with the skull removed in this particular character. I'm definitely, you know, I have all of these, every single one of these. And so I will be very, very interested in how your listeners begin to solve some of these problems, because I work at it every single day.
Yeah. So maybe you need to do this on a vacation week instead of Iowa caucus week.
I won't pick that week. I won't pick that week. Yes. And I should warn my staff if I decide to do this, right?
Well, unless you choose up to date on the news, in which case maybe they'll be grateful, John, that that's been your goal.
Manoush Zomorodi, helping to make our information lives magical on Note to Self. Check it out. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here, John.
Bright lights of Denver are shining like diamonds, like 10,000 jewels in the sky.
I've been traveling around this city of Denver all week, and it's so easy to get around. Ramps everywhere, public transit that's accessible. This changing city is redefining itself, making public transit work where there was none before. It's exciting to see so much modern infrastructure being built here. And I come from a city, New York, that hasn't built a major new bridge for a century. This is a place where redesign is changing the landscape, and that feels exciting and new, as though the whole community is caught up in change, seeing its benefits. Design aims for a higher quality of life, but does it only reach those who can afford it? Ever had sticker shock at a Uniqlo store or a West Elm store? It's exactly the kind of question that our next guest is thinking about. Kiga Vid is a Danish designer and CEO of Index, Designed to Improve Life. It's an NGO that pushes designers to find sustainable solutions that close the gap of inequality. And she's hard at work right here in Denver, trying to harvest the potential she sees in all American cities, empowering citizens to act like designers, whether they use that word or not.
Design is something you do all the time. Someone does design in another way. They train it. They go to school and learn it. But you always do design when you reshuffle your environment. That's kind of design as well. So I see design merely as a tool that we use to create an environment that gives meaning to our lives.
So many institutions are concerned about the inequality that exists in terms of income, in terms of experience, access to digital communications. There's a whole range of issues that there's radical inequality. What kind of design rectifies the inequality, and what kind of design sets cues in the environment that causes people to resist that inequality? What kinds of design choices would you make that represents one and one that represents maybe the other option?
I would say inequality. And right now, as you know, in Europe, we're facing a very big struggle in terms of refugees coming in, which is one of the biggest, more significant signals of inequality right now in the world, as I see it. Inequality is addressed by education, mainly. So design really good education and make it accessible for people. Another thing is that inequality happens when you don't understand other people. We all tend, all of us, to live in the environment with people we know, people that has the same income and the same education, the same experience, the same culture as we do. So what design can do to counter inequality is also to design ways that we can meet other people that are not like us. That's actually one of the tools we can use.
What is a tangible design tool that crosses the language barrier in ways that were unimaginable a generation ago, do you think?
There's a lot of community design right now, for instance, for elderly people. where you, instead of getting food to elderly people that cannot make food for themselves, what you do now is you tend to bring the elderly people outside of their houses to meet other people, to meet other cultures. Another one is Duolingo, which is, of course, only a website or an app-based design. You learn to understand how other people speak. And that's an amazing app that was designed at Carnegie Mellon in the U.S. So that's a way of understanding different languages and understand different people by that.
You have four basic ideas, drivers for bringing design more into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what those are?
When we look upon design, we think there are three areas that are very important. One is that you inspire people, show them the tangible examples of how design can actually improve your life. Then we need to educate people. That's another example. And then we think it's important to reach out. So we have engage. So design does not only become an idea, a great, beautiful idea, but also is realized. Another way to look upon this kind of design is that normally when you assess design, you would only look at the form, the beauty, the colors, the materials. That's the traditional way of looking at design. When we look upon design, we also assess the impact of the design. How big is the challenge that you address? How relevant is it? How relevant is it to how many people? And then we look into the context of the design. Coming from a very design-savvy nation, which is Denmark, we tend to believe that the design we like is globally likable, but design is about culture as well. So if you want to address a big challenge in another country or in developing countries, for instance, you need to know the context there. You need to go there. You cannot sit in our part of the world and design for India. You need to understand the context and the culture and the ethics in India.
Even in Denmark, does the ethos of good design make its way into every part of the society? For instance, is Copenhagen a utopia of good design if I wander around the city?
Actually, yes, I would say that. Design in Denmark is based on our welfare society, which is an old welfare society with the principle of having the biggest shoulders carrying the biggest loads. So our design tradition is made from this principle. So we tend to take care of people also in our design, which on a very basic level means we have a lot of street light. It feels safe in Copenhagen. We have a lot of bike lanes. Actually, nearly 60% of all Copenhageners are biking to work. But I like Copenhagen because it's designed on a human scale. So many cities are designed to be humongous, big, you know, and the buildings are big and so on. In Copenhagen, you have 5-storage, and that's it. And that makes it more easy for people to understand, I think. It feels people-like, I think.
What's the experience of Europe in changing its strategy when changes in population, changes in ethnicity happen? Mm-hmm. And do you think Europe is good at shifting strategies in midstream?
I think it's really difficult for Europe right now. Europe were like quite seclusive for many, 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 many years, for centuries. And now we have all these new people coming in, and that's nobody knows what to do about it. The other thing that in terms of sustainability, I think the European cities are really doing a good job on the practical infrastructural level. The cities handled really well, but on the human scale, in terms of taking different people in that are different from the original inhabitants, it's really, really, really difficult.
Kiga Vid is a Danish designer and CEO of Index, designed to improve life, an NGO that inspires designers to find sustainable solutions to improve the lives of others. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Copenhagen might be one of the best designed cities for people, but maybe not for recent migrants. Denmark's parliament is expected to vote Tuesday in favor of drastic reforms curbing asylum seekers' rights, including delaying family reunifications and confiscating migrants' valuables. If you are not a star and not a Catherine Bigelow or a J.J. Abrams director, what good are you? How can you get into the movie and entertainment business, which pulled in $10.8 billion last year?
because of the emerging dependence on social media and internet ages, I feel like it's a lot easier to get yourself out there more.
You can make a film off an iPhone now. I mean, back in the day, it cost so much money to buy tape and cameras and equipment, and it's still costly today, but not nearly to the magnitude. And it's just very accessible now to the public, I feel like.
Luke Austin and Michelle Lee are students at the University of Denver College of Arts and Media, discovering how to make accessible, creative tools become real jobs in an industry that values stardom and hits above all else. Ruth Vitale is an independent film producer and CEO of Creative Futures, an organization that embraces digital change and educates young people about digital piracy. She's been fighting the diversity battle in Hollywood for a long time, telling young people that they don't have to be a big star actor or director to make it in a great job in the biz.
We've gone into third and fourth grade classes with Congressman Doug Collins in Buford, Georgia, and the principal had said to us, "You're not going to have more than 45 minutes. So these kids are going to be like running around the gym with their, you know, like crazy because they don't sit." They sat for over an hour and a half, cross-legged, listening to the sound guy talk about the boom and how he operates the clapboard, the special effects person who showed them how to make snow and dirt, and the props guy who showed them that you can make a bottle that can break over a head and not hurt anybody. These kids were wide-eyed. A teacher afterwards said it's the best assembly she'd seen in 17 years. Now that's the message we have to get out to kids. You can be part of the business. You're limited only by your imagination.
Oh, that's so great. Did they do the celery crunch where you crunch the celery and that's the breaking of the neck?
And they also did, he did the rubber mallet hammer that you like, you know, that you can smack somebody with. And one of the little girls broke a rock sugar bottle over my head and she was terrified. I was like, no, it's okay. And then, of course, I pretended to fall down and faint. But the kids were like, oh, my gosh. Because they don't know.
Hmm.
How would you? My mother, I've been in the business 30 years. My mother still doesn't know what I do. I love you, Mom.
Speaking of which, does it annoy you or what's your commentary on how, you know, there's a big movie, Steve Jobs, The Social Network, all about extolling the virtues and making cool these people who on some level are responsible for creating the tools for piracy, you know, number one. And number two, sort of getting away from the creation of content. These are device creators. These are fascinating people, but they're not movie stars, really, even though...
No. Although, I have to say, Michael Fassbender did an amazing job. I really did love that movie. I was mesmerized by that film. In this job, I've learned an awful lot about the other side that I didn't know. When you work in our business, right, just making movies or distributing movies, you're kind of, your head's down. You don't even realize piracy is an issue, particularly. There are some who always have. There are people that are in content protection that have. But filmmakers are making their movies, right? And until it hits them personally, it's kind of like, ooh. So I say this all the time. We can't live without each other. I've spoken at a tech conference here in Denver 2 Augusts ago where I said in front of like 250 technologists, I love what you do. Without what you've created, we would not be able to reach our audiences as efficiently and as quickly as they want us to. But without us, you guys have 24/7 cat videos. And one of the guys came up to me afterwards and said, thanks for speaking the truth. And I said, listen, we need each other. I have testified at the House congressional hearings. They're talking about opening up copyright. And I was up in Santa Clara with all the people from the other side. And I said to them, I'm generally known as a fighter, but I don't think this is an opportunity or the time to fight. The time now is to work together so that everyone can make money. Right? Without copyright, without what we need, we cannot be creative and innovative because copyright allows us to be paid for the work and the sweat and the hard labor we put in. So I love technology. And when I hear the other side say that we're Luddites and we're not working fast enough, we have product available on over 400 platforms. We make it available as soon as we can. It's not like we're holding it back so people can't see it, but money, we have to make back the money that we have put out to make these movies and television and music as well.
Is streaming hit its peak and it's going to be more rational, hit-oriented versus what it seems to have been in the last couple of years where there's just an explosion of content. Is there a peak there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think people are continuing to make programming, and I think that the more people that come into the business with platforms to deliver programming, there's going to be a need for it. It's the least expensive form of entertainment. So when I go in to talk to kids, I say, don't let anybody, anyone, minimize the value of what you want to do with your life. Because telling stories are what inspires us, challenges us to ask questions, to think differently, to think outside the box. You can't put a price on that.
Ruth Vitale is an indie film producer and CEO of Creative Futures.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
My mom was very into all her kids learning useful skills, so I've sewed things by hand. Lots of people have. But when I saw my first sewing machine, and we had an old one, going up and down as I pushed the pedals, I was fascinated. Needle with thread up, move fabric. Needle down, repeat. Slow or fast, one needle or 500. It's the same idea. The Takeaway's search for America's greatest innovation continues today, and I don't want to prejudice the proceedings. But a sewing machine, there's an innovation that's hard to beat. From such simplicity comes the repair of a torn favorite jacket, all the dazzle of fashion, and the miracle of Hollywood costumes. Deborah Nadulman Landis, a Hollywood costume designer, wants you to vote for the sewing machine.
Hi, I'm Deborah Nadulman Landis, and I'm in the business of making movies. As a costume designer, it's my job to create characters that the audience will never forget. And the one thing that costume designers can't do without is one of America's most remarkable and underappreciated inventions, the sewing machine. Indiana Jones and his trademark hat and leather jacket, it's my design.
That belongs in a museum.
And Michael Jackson's jacket, you know, the one he wore in Thriller, that's my design too. For the millions of men and women caught up in the Industrial Revolution, the sewing machine was transformative. It provided a place for new immigrants in the job market. And for the first time, it gave women the opportunity to make their own money, join organized labor, and to start their own businesses. The sewing machine, as we know it today, didn't become a marketable appliance until 1846. That's when inventor Elias Howe patented a new design that revolutionized the clothing industry. For too long, the sewing machine's significance has been overlooked. It deserves its place next to the light bulb and the refrigerator as an invention whose social, cultural, and economic impact has been profound. We rely on the sewing machine for our stylish jeans and boots, to upholster our homes, tents, offices, and cars, and for some of us, to make Harrison Ford and Michael Jackson look amazing.
Make it work.
Please do the right thing and vote for the sewing machine, America's greatest invention.
What do you think is America's greatest innovation? You can vote for the sewing machine. You can nominate an American invention of your own. You can visit thetakeaway.org/innovation. You can vote for the electric guitar, for instance. We'll have multiple rounds of voting over the next month and eventually crown a champion. And we've been hearing your nominations as well.
My name is Matt Hammond from Detroit, Michigan. And I just wanted to say that the most amazing American invention is the transistor, because it basically replaced the vacuum tube and made all modern technology possible.
This is Flint Beard in Dallas, Texas. If there is a list being made of the most influential innovations in America, hydraulic fracturing on a horizontal well definitely has to become one of the top contenders.
Hi, my name is Don Splittorff, and I'm calling from Easley, South Carolina. And I'd like to nominate the thermos bottle, because it keeps hot things hot, cold things cold. And how does it know how to do that?
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Before we go, a sad moment. My dear friend and a true pioneer and innovator, MIT professor Marvin Minsky, has died this week at age 88. A wondrous, long, and interesting life working with legendary scientists John von Neumann, Richard Feynman, among others, eventually becoming one of them. Marvin Minsky helped bring the personal computer into existence. He imagined human evolution as a collaboration between biology and machines, neural networks, artificial intelligence, thinking of emotion in terms of artificial intelligence. These were all Marvin Minsky's groundbreaking domains. Marvin, with his ever-present khaki fishing vest, with pockets full of tools, he was such a gentle genius. He loved to play Bach for the beauty of the math on the piano. He could play the two-part inventions forwards and backwards. I'd sometimes sit with him at a piano at the MIT Media Lab watching him compose little simulated Bach pieces. "Here are the rules," he said. "Now listen to all the beauty." Marvin's curiosity was a gift to all of us. He conveyed a sense of wonder about the most complicated things. Even if you couldn't grasp the math, you couldn't miss the joy. Marvin, I thought he would live forever. He even had a certain wonder and curiosity about the end of his life, its little fascinating details. I can imagine him losing his precious consciousness at the end, a peaceful end, his family said. But observing himself slipping away, instead of saying goodbye, he would say something like, "Hey, this is interesting. Just a minute." It is for us to say goodbye. Marvin is off exploring some wondrous new experience. Goodbye, Marvin Minsky. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckleberry. Thanks for listening.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.